pleasure to introduce our speaker today for Grand Rounds, Rabbi Jason Weiner. Rabbi Weiner has been an amazing contributor to Cedar Sinai in the time that I've been here. He succeeded an extremely successful tenure by a senior rabbi here, and he has personally enriched the environment here. And it's reflective of his intellectual experience and outlook. He went to school at California State University and then to Yeshiva University, where he got a master's in Jewish history and then rabbinical ordination in 2006. Noteworthy, in addition to his career achievements that I'll mention in a minute, is he has another master's degree in bioethics and health policy, followed by a doctorate in clinical bioethics. His contributions have included three books, several of which are directly related to the topic that he's going to speak on today. He has been the rabbi of a very well-respected synagogue here in Los Angeles. He's been the president of the rabbi group in Southern California, and has published numerous highly respected academic pieces about the intersection between religion and our jobs as caretakers of the sick. He has also been a friend to many of us in our more difficult times, and his leadership of our very diverse spiritual group here has been impeccable, and I think has professionalized this to a level that few hospitals could possibly compete with. So not only is he a fine scholar and a wonderful spiritual advisor, he is also a deft administrator, for which we are deeply appreciative. His topic today is a very interesting one that's relevant certainly in this time of COVID and post-COVID, hopefully. And it has to do with the limits of practitioners in dealing with patients and others. Jason, thank you so much for doing this. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Goritz, and it's really mutual. You've been also a great leader and so kind and welcoming to me, and I really enjoyed getting to know you and seeing all of your incredible accomplishments. And the Department of Surgery, you know, has been such an incredible place and a beacon here at Cedars-Sinai. You mentioned my predecessors. You know, actually today I will be performing the funeral for Dr. Stephen Shapiro, who just died suddenly this weekend, and was the chief of surgery here for a number of years. And I obviously want to dedicate my presentation to him. And also, he was a student of Dr. Leon Morgenstern. And Dr. Morgenstern was, you know, a really great leader here at this hospital for a number of years, until he died at the age of 94, still coming to the hospital on a regular basis. And Dr. Morgenstern, I once had the opportunity to give a presentation where he was in the audience. It was a small group, and he was a very demanding leader. And he listened to my presentation for an hour, and then he raised his hand, and I knew it would be a good question, as he always asked. And he said, you know, Rabbi, I'm 92 years old. I calculate every second of my day carefully to make the best use of it. And that hour is one that I will never get back now because of you. How do you justify what you just did in that last hour? That was a complete waste of my time. And he said it in a loving way, obviously, but he meant to teach me a lesson, which was, you know, you really need to prepare before you give a presentation and make sure that it is relevant to my life and not just some kind of random sources that you're kind of quoting here and there, but let's actually talk about, like, how to improve our practice. And I was really shocked by his comments, but then also appreciative, because he reminded me of that. And it goes to, you know, Dr. Goritz's introduction. You know, so yes, I have training in bioethics, and I'm interested in various types of scholarship. Primarily, my role here is as rabbi, as director of the spiritual care department. But obviously, I'm speaking here today, and I try to always speak to, you know, a diverse audience, and I'm not trying to push Judaism or assume that people care more about what Judaism has to say about their everyday life. I want to actually discuss issues that are relevant to every practitioner, and from a perspective and a vocabulary that's understandable and relatable by everybody. But also, as a rabbi, I want to try to show if there are insights and wisdom that the Jewish tradition has to provide that are relevant to every single person, that maybe could make my perspective unique and different. And so this presentation, the focus will be on general principles that relate to this issue of how far can we be expected to go for our patients, but then to provide a unique insight that I think is relevant for everyone, but is based on the Jewish tradition. And maybe I'll start. Dr. Gortz mentioned, you know, how this topic is related to kind of or became especially relevant and central during the COVID pandemic. And I'll share with you a story that got me really thinking about these topics. And it's just one example. I mean, there could be so many more, and I'm sure you all have many in your own practice as well. There was a patient towards the beginning part of the pandemic who was here with COVID, and he was a Holocaust survivor. And his family was very anxious that, you know, how he was doing. He was very elderly. And they were not allowed in. Obviously, at that time, there was no visitors allowed in the hospital. But they were very nervous for their father and grandfather and loved one. And so they asked me to check on him as I was here inside the hospital. And sometimes I'd go and, you know, FaceTime with them and just make sure that they were in touch with him. And one day I went to visit this patient. And remember, this is towards the beginning of COVID. And obviously, I mean, still until this day, we're being, you know, very careful. We take it very seriously. And I was obviously all gowned up and everything. And I was in his room. And he sort of begged to me that he was very, very thirsty. He hadn't drank anything that whole day. And especially, this was especially traumatic as a Holocaust survivor. You know, the experience of extreme starvation or thirst, it can be very traumatic. And so I kind of knocked on the window and asked the nurse if I could give him some water. And she said, actually, please do. We aren't able to go in as much as we'd like to, and he's very thirsty. So I poured him a cup of water, and I gave him water. Now, obviously, he has to take his mask off to drink the water, and I'm sort of standing over him to help him drink it. But he drank it so quickly because he was so thirsty that, obviously, he began to choke and cough. And he sort of turned to me and coughed the water all over me. And now, this was before, you know, vaccines or any kind of treatment for COVID, and now I'm dripping with, you know, COVID-infected water, and just thinking to myself, like, am I doing the right thing? Like, is this okay? Like, I'm now soaked with water spit on me from a COVID patient, and I'm going to have to go home to my family, and, like, obviously, I don't want to get COVID, and I'm thinking, like, was it worth it for me to help, you know, support this person emotionally and to give him some water, but for me to have to be so exposed. And that's really got me thinking. Obviously, that's just kind of one example, but there could be so much more. And so I want to start talking a little bit about some of the perspectives on this, because, you know, we do know from data, and you can think for yourselves as you're listening to this, each of you, but surveys show that most healthcare professionals enter the healthcare profession primarily out of a desire to help those in need. It's, you know, people go into different jobs for different reasons, but healthcare professionals tend to be very idealistic, and they want to help people, and therefore they take upon themselves more burdens to help others. And if you could just mute yourselves. So this even exacerbates the question, because people are so interested in wanting to help that they take upon higher burdens. And so where does this, what is the basic expectation for healthcare providers? And you can look at a few different places. There are, you know, very popular codes and treatises that have been written throughout time about, you know, the expectations of doctors and the oaths that physicians in particular take upon themselves. And for example, a popular contemporary rendition of the Hippocratic Oath, which is basically, it is the Hippocratic Oath just put into contemporary language, doctors promise as follows, that they will treat without exception all who seek my ministrations. Treat without exception all who seek my ministrations. And in 2001, the American Medical Association developed a social contract with humanity. And in that contract, it says we commit as physicians to apply our knowledge and skills when needed, though doing so may put us at risk. Now, my question really is that the expectation? Is that what all healthcare professionals are expected to do? That they will apply their knowledge and skills whenever needed, anytime, and no matter how much risk they're put at? Is there a limit? Is there a time when it's right to say no? When a person, when a doctor, a healthcare professional can say, this is too much for me, I can't do this? Is that ever appropriate for a healthcare professional? And, you know, in COVID in particular, we saw increases in healthcare professionals in anxiety, exhaustion, depression, PTSD, burnout, and unfortunately, suicide. And that led to, obviously, many people quitting the healthcare profession. And so this exacerbates the question, because it can't be that the expectation is to do everything no matter what at all times, no matter how much risk one puts themselves into as a result. But that you do find in classical medical and bioethical writings very strong support for very high expectations of how much a healthcare professional should be expected to put themselves into. And so, as some examples, there are some principles in bioethics that that support a very high bar of expectation for a healthcare provider to put themselves even at risk to help others. One of them is called the common morality. Common morality means that basically, commonly, you know, everyone is expected to help others in need. You're walking down the street, someone collapses, you're on a plane, someone's yelling out for a doctor, but even if it's not a doctor, let's say it's even more common than that. It's just someone needs help. It's just not right to walk by them and do nothing about it. We want to try to help people when they are in need. And what goes along with that common morality is that the expectation increases as one develops necessary training and skills and is in a position to help others. So if I'm on that plane and someone is choking, let's say, okay, so maybe I can try the Heimlich maneuver. I've been trained in that. I could try it. But let's say they need something more sophisticated than that, and they really need a doctor. And I'm not a doctor. I'm not a medical doctor, right? So it's probably not only am I not expected to try to get involved in some kind of medical intervention, it might even be inappropriate. It might do more harm than good. But once someone has training and the ability to help those in need, the expectation, the common morality expectation of that individual goes up. So once someone has attended medical school and then residency and whatever expertise that person has gained, their expectations increase of what can be expected. And that's just a basic common morality. There's also something that you find in the bioethics literature that's called implied consent. Also elsewhere it's referred to as express consent. And that simply means that it's not just the training that one receives. It's not just the fact that you know how to help that person in need. But it's that once one accepts a job as a healthcare provider, and they say, yes, I am going to work as a doctor, a nurse, a surgeon, then you are implicitly consenting to any risks and expectations associated with that field. So if some interventions might involve risk, you know, one could easily say that me, as a chaplain, once I said I'm going to work as a chaplain and I am going to be in the hospital during a pandemic and I'm here to help patients, so I implicitly consented that, you know, I might then get spit on by COVID patients. They might choke on their water. I might end up wet with COVID on me, right? As far as I know, I didn't get COVID actually from that patient. I don't think I ever got COVID during the pandemic, but, you know, I never tested positive. Who knows what happened in the hospital, but thank God. Anyways, but my point is that by accepting the job has expectations, and that's the sort of implied consent. Once you're standing there and you're at risk, it's too late to say, like, oh, no, do I want to do this? Well, if you're doing the job, you've already consented to that risk. That's another argument. And a third argument, somewhat controversial argument within the literature, but a strong argument. In fact, actually, it's the most commonly cited argument, in my research at least, is what's called reciprocity or social contract. And this, again, as I'm talking about these different theories, think to yourself, how much does it apply to you? Because it will apply to each person differently, as you'll see what I mean. So reciprocity, or the social contract, what that means is that as a healthcare provider, you, and I'll even say we, you know, as an employee of Cedars-Sinai, we receive numerous benefits from society. And those benefits afford exclusivity, opportunities for higher salaries, and this might include government or taxpayer subsidized educations that we received, social prestige, self-regulation with our own societies, meaning not government regulation, but we have our own internal regulation, which is based on trust, and we are trusted by society. There's a certain access to medical care, and these protective measures that protect us, and like I said, offer oftentimes higher salaries. So this obligates healthcare professionals to provide a public service and put themselves at more risk than others, right? It's well known, Cedars-Sinai, part of the cost of care at Cedars-Sinai is that we train residents. That's a very important part of our field. And as I spoke about, Dr. Goertz and Dr. Shapiro of blessed memory and Dr. Morgenstern and our legacy of training, of amazing training of residents. So there ends up being like, well, if you're going to include in your costs of care, your training of residents, then once those residents are practicing medicine, there is a sort of social contract. They've benefited from society, from taxpayer money, from healthcare payer patients, from health insurance. And now the society says like, okay, we've given you a lot. We give you a lot of prestige. Now we also expect you to help others in need. Society needs doctors. Society needs healthcare providers. And yeah, it might mean you put yourself at risk, but that's what you signed up for. And so the idea is that this special training, this status, it combined with the patient's vulnerability, patients are relying on us, it creates a duty to put the patient's needs over even our own needs. We have to elevate their needs. They are vulnerable. They are in need. We have the ability to help them, and we are therefore expected to do so to the best of our ability, even if it puts ourselves at risk. Those are three very common theories. But now the question is, first of all, hopefully you were thinking, as I mentioned these three theories, do they apply to you? And you might have thought to yourself, well, wait a second, I didn't take those oaths. Not everyone takes those oaths. And anyways, even if you did take those oaths, I mean, how binding are they? Sometimes they're somewhat symbolic, right? And not all doctors are members or healthcare professionals are members of professional organizations. Not all receive the same benefits from society. Not everyone received scholarships or the same sort of residency. Or maybe someone might say, I've paid back. Yeah, maybe I owe something for that, but I've basically paid it back. Not everyone is like Dr. Morgenstern and works into their 90s, right? Maybe someone says at a certain point, but still, at a certain point, I've paid back my debt to society. And do I really have to risk myself? And to what extent do I really have to risk myself? Fine, I'm willing to engage in inconveniences for the sake of my patients, but does that mean that I have to really risk my life? I mean, that's asking quite a bit. And if I did so, would that really be the right thing? Would it really be right to risk my life? I mean, you only have one life. And so let's talk about one other category, so to speak, in the bioethics literature that obligates risk and care to others. And that is the principle of beneficence. You know that within bioethics, there's discussion of, the principles of autonomy and maleficence and justice and beneficence. And they're based on basic philosophical principles. Though the truth is that the value of beneficence, the fact that we are expected to act beneficently, kindly, caringly towards our patients, is partially based on the Bible, actually. It's based on the Torah's obligation, love your neighbor as yourself. And even within the bioethics literature, today, it's more secular than it was in the past. But you see, there was some acknowledgement, a recognition that that's where this sort of morality comes from, of the value of helping other people. And in Judaism, this is an obligation. It's not just a nice idea. It's an obligation. It's to all people. In the bioethics literature and medical scholarship, there is a big debate about the value of beneficence. And that debate is it specific or general? That's what I wrote here on the slide. Debate between specific versus general beneficence. What does that mean? So some ask, yeah, fine. I'm obligated to act beneficently towards my patients. That obviously, that makes sense. That's a beautiful thing. But to my patients, meaning it's to people that I have a relationship with. Am I obligated to help every single person? If I see on the news about someone suffering somewhere else in the world, am I obligated to get on a plane just because I know how to treat that patient? How far does my obligation go? Yes, I have to act beneficently, but to my patients specifically. Or is there a general expectation that's owed equally to all people? Right? Which some would argue, by the way, if I was, that would be quite an expectation to owe that beneficence to every single human being. Many argue that is expected, but that could also divert one's attention away from their own patients. And maybe it's an ideal, like it's a beautiful idea, right? I want to care about every single human in the world. Yes, that is a beautiful ideal. But is it an obligation? An obligation is quite a high bar to say, right? How far do I have to go? You're laying down in bed at night. Finally, you know, it's 1 a.m. You're exhausted. And you see that someone is sick and in need at a hospital that, you know, that you might have privileges at, but it's an hour drive away. And there is someone else, you know, there's a resident going on their way. But do you have to get out of your bed and go there because you think you might be able to help them? How far is this obligation? Even if it's an ideal, like, okay, if I was in the neighborhood, I would go help. But right now, it's just too difficult. So how far do we go with that? That's a big debate within the bioethics literature. Does beneficence apply specifically to your patients or generally to all people? But the majority opinion, the kind of mainstream approach, is that no. There's no requirement of general beneficence to all people. Although one, of course, could go above and beyond. But you're only also expected to promote the health of your patient, not their overall well-being, because that's another debate. When we say that we owe a beneficence to our patients, does that mean to their health, meaning their physical health, or their overall well-being, mental health, emotional health, all these different aspects of what it means to be human? I'll even say spiritual health, right? We have, thank God, amazing chaplains here at Cedars-Sinai, but let's say you're at a hospital that was not blessed with so many wonderful chaplains, right? Is the doctor expected to be their spiritual health provider as well? So, no, the expectation primarily is on their physical health, although there is discussion of this, right? What does it mean to be beneficent? Maybe it does mean that I should be caring for the whole person, and that definition of health should be taken much more broadly. But the consensus is that when one is well positioned to help another person, yes, they should, despite the risks. But there's debate about the level of obligation and the level of risk. And so that's what we're going to start to get a little more specific with now and start to get towards some answers. There is significant discussion about this risk in the bioethics literature that, you know, entering such risks, for example, COVID, by treating a highly contagious illness could lead to a shortage of medical professionals, thus endangering the public. And this is in the literature, talks about, for example, Italy in the very beginning of the pandemic. So one reason to limit the expectations of risk is that we don't want to cause a shortage of medical professionals. That would be, from a societal, from a public health standpoint, a disaster. So there is reason for a healthcare professional to protect their health, because that is actually for the overall good, right? Keep yourselves healthy so that you can continue to care for patients. And obviously there's concerns related to transmitting disease to vulnerable family members, and some healthcare professionals are themselves vulnerable. So obviously there are limits. Truth is, in Jewish literature, the rabbis talk about how medical professionals are expected to endanger themselves in such circumstances because for the sake of public safety and to try to prevent a mass outbreak. So on the one hand, you have kind of a debate here, like should a healthcare professional be cautious so we don't have a shortage of healthcare professionals, or should they be extra aggressive to try to prevent the spread and the impact of an outbreak? And the rabbis seem to favor the latter approach, the being more aggressive in terms of risking oneself, whereas in the bioethics literature, you see a little bit more understanding for the concept of, you know, prevent a shortage of healthcare professionals. In Judaism there is, and in the health bioethics literature, there's some discussion about, you know, you need to have some limits though. Because if there's no limits on the expectations of a healthcare provider, no one will go into the healthcare profession. We're already experiencing these concerns today, post-pandemic, or, since the beginning of the pandemic, of less people wanting to go into healthcare because of fear. And can you maintain such a lifestyle if you would expect people to risk themselves and endanger themselves? Will people want to be
doctors, will people want to go into healthcare, and will they do a good job? And so, for example, Judaism says, like, one is not liable for damages caused en route to save someone's life. You know, there is discussion amongst the rabbis, can a physician take an extra job, let's say at night, a night job? Actually, they talk about this with surgeons. Could a surgeon take a night job to make extra money on the side if they will be exhausted in the morning and unable to properly engage in surgery? And the rabbis say, no, they're actually not allowed to. And then they hold healthcare professionals liable for errors if they're an error related to lack of care, to not being careful enough. But we're going to come back to that as with my final kind of main point that I want to make in just a few minutes. But let's talk just for a minute about some of the limits, some other limits that you find within the bioethics literature. So, of course, one can't be expected to do everything at all costs despite the risk. And so you find in some writings in bioethics, for example, there's a responsibility to care for oneself and maintain one's own well-being. And in particular, there's a fascinating discussion in the last 5 years, 6 years or so, you know, residency, you know, they used to be, as you're all well aware, you know, these 48-hour shifts and these incredibly demanding, non-human expectations of medical residency, just the hours and the physical demandingness. And that has shifted somewhat, right? It's still, of course, very demanding. I mean, I hold you all in the greatest respect and awe. Though there's been a little bit of a shift. And the shift has focused from inculcating a strong work ethic and professionalism and stamina and self-sacrifice to developing compassion, empathy, self-care, recognizing that being overworked can drain one's compassion and motivation and lead to burnout, and that causes errors and actually harm to patients. And so some of the shifts that we're seeing in the hours and expectations of medical residents is based on this shifting perspective, which in my opinion, I assume many of yours, but I mean, open for debate, is a good thing. It's a good shift because it does promote overall better well-being of medical professionals and thereby hopefully better outcomes for patients. So that's just a basic recognition. And also, you know, there's also recognition that simply it would be impossible to function long-term as in any profession, if one thinks they must solve an exhaustible amount of suffering in the world. There, you know, we as humans, we have finite capacities, and there is unfortunately, an infinite amount of suffering in the world. I mean, you just watch the news or talk to your friends. I mean, it's just, there's so much horrible things happening in the world. And yes, we should be trying to alleviate the suffering in the world and helping people and making the world a better place. But we have to have normal expectations of how much we are capable of limiting that suffering in the world. It's just, there's only so much that each of us can do. We have to have realistic expectations of that. That's in the bioethics literature. Now, with that could, I could say, you know, okay, that's the end of my presentation. The thing is, I still have 15 minutes left. I have to fill it. I'm just joking. No, now I get to the main point. The whole purpose of my presentation of being here today. Everything I said till now was a summary. Everything I said till now, you could have figured out using PubMed and reading some books. This was all, I think, kind of a summary of the literature and the debate, which is that, you know, healthcare professionals, we go into this profession to do good, to help people. There's basic expectations and oaths and social contracts to risk oneself. But there's an understanding that you can only risk yourself so much. What I want to provide now is my own insight. And it does come from my tradition. But as I said at the outset, this is not meant to suggest that people should be only looking to Judaism. You know, I don't expect every person to think, I'm not trying to push Judaism in any way or anything like that. I'm just trying to share that in my own search about this question and my own struggles with how far can we be expected to go, as I researched it, I came across and developed an approach that for me has been very meaningful. I think it's very well anchored, and I think about it on a regular basis, and I suggest it to others on a regular basis, and so now I want to suggest it to you. This is, I think, a slightly novel approach, and so I really am curious to hear your reactions, and I hope it's helpful to you. This is my, you know, my gift, so to speak, like what I'm trying to provide for you. And but I really want to hear your feedback in particular. I really respect the Department of Surgery and those of you on this call and your intelligence. And I have a lot to learn. So please, you know, feel free to push back and share how this works for you, even if not just today, even if over the coming weeks, if you're able to think about this and how it impacts your life. Let me know what, if it makes sense to you. So here's where it comes from. There is a verse in the Torah which says, everything that I give you, everything that you give me, I will tithe to you. And this is the concept of tithing, which is popular in many religions, where one is expected to give one-tenth of their income or their possessions to charity, to those in need. We're expected to give one-tenth. That's the rule. That's in Judaism and many religions. And the truth is, if in effect of altruism and a movement today, I mean, there are many movements, even non-religious movements, that believe in and promote the ideals of giving a certain percentage of one's means to those in need. Interestingly, though, the rabbis limited this. They said, yes, you are expected to give one-tenth of your income to those in need. And you know, that can be difficult, right? People need their money, but you were expected to give and help others and give one-tenth. But, the rabbi said, we may not give more than a fifth. Just fascinating. We must give a tenth, so you must push yourself to give. But we may not give more than a fifth. That, the rabbi said, unless one is fabulously wealthy, that, they said, is too much. Because then one will become dependent on others. And the Torah, you know, is saying that we don't want people to spend all of their money on one good action, because that will leave them destitute and unable to perform other meritorious acts. So therefore, we have to ration the way we distribute our resources. So that's the rule. And that's a rule that's well known within the Jewish tradition and fairly straightforward, right? If one makes $100, they must give $10 away to those in need, but should not give more than $20 away, right? Just to use an example. That's the rule. But now I want to share with you a novel application of that, which when one does mine the rabbinic tradition and search for different approaches, I'm not saying is very well known or commonplace, but you do find a fascinating approach within the rabbinic literature going back a number of hundred years, which is that even though the rabbis of the Talmud and the Torah itself, the Bible itself, are talking about financial giving here, one is also not expected to become physically ill in order to fulfill a commandment. In other words, financial well-being should not be more important to one than their physical well-being. And since most people would be willing to spend much more than a fifth of their money to avoid severe suffering, so the rabbis said that enduring tremendous suffering or giving a large amount of one's time would be tantamount to spending more than a fifth of one's resources. So there's a limit not just to how much one can give of their financial means, but there's a limit on the extent to which one is expected to give of themselves, of their own well-being, of their own essence. They can only give, yes, we must give a tenth of ourselves. We cannot walk around the world only thinking about ourselves. We have to be giving of ourselves. And even amount that might hurt a little bit, like, I really have to give. I want to keep it for myself, but no, I have to give. So there's an expectation to help other people, yes. There's also an obligation to help them only to a certain extent. Of course, we're not talking necessarily here about, you know, saving a life for one's patient. I mean, there are limits, and we have to still, you know, do everything we can to help others. However, the rabbis felt that you know, you don't have to. First of all, even if it's to save a life, in some situations, if one would have to give of themselves more than a fifth, that obligation should be shared by the entire community. Right? It can't all fall on one person, right? Which is expected, and the community is then, therefore, expected to protect the general public's financial viability. Now, this goes into, you know, healthcare expectations of the government and of society. That's a different conversation. But there is an expectation of society to do their part, and everyone in society to do their part by contributing to communal needs, But no one individual can be required to spend everything that they have in order to do it all on their own. We don't say that one person has to do everything. And to expect a healthcare provider to be available at all times and do everything they can on behalf of any patient in need, that could drain all of a person's emotional and financial resources. And that would jeopardize others to whom they also owe responsibility, because we don't have one patient. And if we're, and similar to what was said before, this exact same reasoning of the rabbis was, if we were to give all of our money to fulfill one commandment, well, there's a lot of other commandments and we would not be able to do any of them. So too, there's a lot of patients, there's a lot of people. And if we give all of ourselves for one person, that jeopardizes others to whom we also owe responsibility, and it could thus be said to cost them more than one-fifth of their wealth. Now, I want to get more specific and talk about healthcare providers. How would we apply this? Because this principle, even though, as I mentioned, it's not extremely well-known within the Jewish community, it does exist amongst rabbinic literature. And there's been some fascinating applications, absolutely fascinating. So, for example, there were those who, there's a fascinating book that I have where someone asked their rabbi a very difficult question. The question was that their parents were emotionally abusive. Not physically, but still emotionally abusive. And it was making their life with their family extremely difficult. They felt very torn, though, because they felt, you know, I have an obligation to honor my parents, and that's important to me. I want to fulfill my obligation. But they're making it possible to live my life. My family, my partner, my children are suffering as a result of the way they're treating me. And it's to the point where I can't handle it. But I'm stuck because, you know, and the way they worded it to their rabbi was, you know, it's in the Ten Commandments to honor your parents. This is just, you know, my emotional well-being. But maybe I have to sacrifice all of that to honor my parents. And one of the great rabbis, going back, quoted this principle. And he said, you know, you're obligated to give a tenth. Yes. If you can sacrifice a little bit, you should. But it sounds to me like you're giving more than a fifth now for that relationship. And in order for your well-being, you're now giving more than a fifth of your mental health, so to speak, to that relationship. And therefore, this rabbi ruled, you may sever that relationship, at least for the time being, if that's what's necessary to productively move forward in your life, which I think was a novel and fascinating application of this rule. I'll give you another example. And I'm not shying away here from, you know, controversial or very difficult conversations, because I want this to be a real discussion. But there was a difficult incident that once happened, and this is all going back, we're going back hundreds of years with many of these examples, but there was some debate about homosexuality in the Jewish community, and there was one individual who knew that he was gay, he was a gay man, and he asked one rabbi, you know, what do I do about this? I feel that I this is who I am, but I don't know if this is prohibited or not. And that rabbi told this person, this man, well, you have to just marry a woman and just ignore your reality, basically. And he was shocked that that was the advice he was given. So he went to another rabbi, a great scholar and a very important rabbi, and he said, is this indeed what I'm required to do? And that rabbi responded, and this is in writing, this is published number of years ago, that would be asking you to give more than a fifth of yourself. Which, again, a fascinating application of this principle. He said, for you, a gay man, to marry a woman, that's asking you to give more than a fifth of your own self, of who you are, of your well-being, and therefore, no, you would not be, of course, obligated to do that. And again, when I read these, I'm thinking, wow, this is a really fascinating principle, and this can be applied to burnout and work-life balance. This can be applied to the healthcare profession, and I apply it every day I think about this. So, for example, let me just try to give an example that tries to quantify this, because we're talking in very sort of qualitative numbers, right? You know, one-fifth, one-tenth, 20%, right? But it's hard to put it into numbers, right? It's a quality. It's how you have to just kind of know when am I giving, how much am I giving of myself, and that's different for each person. But I think that using the numbers could be helpful, and then a person has to simply try to apply it to their lives. But for example, one, let's use the pandemic as an example. So during a pandemic, you know, there was a certain point at which, you know, at the very beginning we thought, okay, it's 2 weeks, we're, it's, you know, there's a shutdown for 2 weeks, hopefully this will be over, and, you know, by, what was it, March, you know, by April, May, we'll be getting back to normal, right? Okay, little did we know. But once we did know, at a certain point we realized, okay, this is a long haul, this pandemic is not going anywhere. So it became crucial to make some decisions about what does it mean not to exceed 20%. So, for example, I started telling people, if you normally work 50 hours a week, I'm just giving you a round number, so I apologize. I'm sure there's many of you on this call, many of us wish we could only work 50 hours a week. But let's just say that was someone who was working 50 hours a week. So what I started telling people was, if that was your norm, 50 hours a week, do not go above 60 hours a week. Okay, 1 week here and there, there might be a especially busy week, something comes up, you can't control that. But on a regular basis, if your norm was 50 hours a week, don't let your norm become more than 60 hours a week. That is giving more than a fifth of yourself. It's too much if that's not what you're able to handle. If you normally take 14 days of vacation per year, you should not take less than 11. Yeah, I understand. Maybe it's harder to get away sometimes. Maybe there's more going on, it's hard to get away. But you have to hold yourself and say, I'm not going to diminish my vacation time by more than a fifth, by more than 20%. So I usually take 14 days. Okay, I can't take as much this year. I'm still going to make sure to get that 11, those 11 days. That's a sort of a numerical way that I think we can sort of quantify this sort of qualitative approach to well-being. But the point is, yeah, we look at the numbers, but each person has to ask themselves, at what point is what I'm being asked to do giving more than a fifth of myself? Is this giving more than a fifth of my well-being? At what point is this akin to working more than 60 hours a week when I'm used to working more than 50 hours a week? At a certain point, when a person is that to the limit, they feel it, right? You feel the exhaustion, the burnout, the sense of, I'm at my limits. So we have to recognize, yes, we are expected to push ourselves and give a little more. A person has to give of themselves. Their time, whatever it is. We have to give a tenth, right? We're supposed to give of ourselves. That is a beautiful thing. That's a basic expectation of healthcare providers in particular. But that does not come without limits. That does not come without recognition that we can only give so much. Limits are vital. And the limits are vital, but what I'm trying to argue, make the point is, not only are they vital, but it's not a weakness. They're philosophically defensible, and we need to have, of course, expectations, but within reason. If we're going to care for others, if we're going to last along the long marathon that our lives are, that our professional lives are, of caring for others, if we're going to be able to care for everyone, not just that one person that has especially high needs, we have to be able to find limits and articulate limits. And to me, this one-fifth principle is a great way to, you know, try to concretize a philosophical recognition that limits are essential, that we have to have limits. So to summarize, yes, I think it's clear that there are very high expectations of responsibility and burdens on healthcare providers. We go into the profession of healthcare because we want to help others, and we take upon burdens to fulfill that sense of duty to help others. We agree to certain oaths and social contracts with humanity. And, you know, we want to help others, and we want to put ourselves at risk. We also recognize that there is exhaustion, there's burnout. And so even though there is a sort of common morality that those especially who have a lot of training and skills are in a position to help others, and they have sort of consented by accepting a job, and they have benefited from society and therefore have a social contract with society to give back, nevertheless, there are limits. We provide beneficence. We want to help people in need, especially those who we are in relationship with, but maybe even beyond that to some extent. But we recognize that we can only do so much. And the way I articulate those limits are the one-fifth principle, giving at least a tenth, but not giving more than a fifth. That is my suggestion as to how we might be able to find some sense of balance and limits, be able to continue to provide that essential care and that wonderful care that you all provide every single day. May you all be able to continue to do so for many, many healthy years to come. I look forward to your questions and comments and pushback.
Well, Rabbi, let me just say that was a fantastic discussion and incredibly timely. I'm very interested in the conversation that hopefully will ensue here. So I'd like to open the floor for any comments.
Thank you so much for doing this presentation, especially given it's so early in the morning, for you guys at least. I'm in New York. Rabbi Weiner, I know you talked about the concept of the one-fifth rule and that there are limits, but I was wondering if I can get some thoughts about what you think about the levels of duty. I know you mentioned that situation with the Holocaust victim where you provided him with water, but I was just thinking, how do you think of this process of limits when it comes to the level of duty at that moment of time, in terms of what situation you're dealing with?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's a challenge. The reason, you know, and every case obviously is unique and different. But my main sort of point here, and this is part of why, you know, I thank Dr. Gewirtz for inviting me and for choosing this topic and for having this, you know, these grand rounds, and why it's so important for healthcare professionals to be involved in sessions such as this one, is because if we want to have any chance of articulating any kind of limits or navigating the difficult scenarios that arise in our practice, at the moment that they occur, we have to have thought about them in advance. You definitely can't be expected to articulate or come up with the proper, way to navigate each situation on the spot, right? That is really asking a lot to sort of, you know, encounter a difficult moment and then say, okay, I know exactly what I'm going to do about this, and then to not regret it afterwards, right? Like, the more we can think about it in advance, the more successful we can potentially be when we encounter them. And every case is unique and specific. So my best answer to you is simply by articulating these principles and thinking through them, we can at least either at the moment kind of have assimilated these ideas and therefore be able to kind of make a gut decision, but based on informed thoughts, or to really say to oneself, is this now, you know, am I now giving more than a fifth of myself for this? You know, I have to ask if I use that Holocaust survivors, you know, choking on me, the COVID water example, like, I have to start asking myself, like, is whatever risk I'm now in, is this a risk that I'm willing to engage in based on how much of it, of myself, it would be giving in the worst case scenario? And that's a case by case determination.
I think this does indeed make sense, and it's grounded in all sorts of substantive religious beliefs that extend certainly beyond Judaism. But my concern is that, you know, I think to your point about understanding our mindset and even the mid days of COVID was we felt we were literally in a war. And during a war, a biological holocaust, if you will, you know, people are expected to serve in extraordinary ways because of extraordinary times.
Yes.
And there was obviously for many healthcare providers, there was certainly appreciation for what people did, but there was an expectation that during this extraordinary challenge that people would not accept limits. Mm. That physicians, nurses, other employees of the hospital would just accept that this was the challenge of a lifetime, and that they were expected to behave in a way that represented that. And while I think that your advice, and not to give double what would normally be expected, is sound advice, the unfortunate thing that I would suggest is that many people within healthcare, not limited to physicians, gave much, much more than that for a relatively long time.
Yeah.
And effectively egregious damage was done
to
their the way they looked at their jobs. It just seemed like it was such an extraordinary circumstance that limitations were eschewed across the board.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I share your perspective on that. And yeah, it is true that there are moments at which one is expected to give much, much more. But articulating limits to that is essential. And we're still dealing with the damage, as you said, of not properly articulating those limits and obligations of self-care.
Yeah, and to your point earlier, you know, it may well be that you know, a lot of folks that live through it will get over it and make their peace with it, and the fallout, the damage of people leaving healthcare won't be quite as great as we anticipate. But what I really fear is the input function will suffer. You know, the children of nurses and physicians will say, why would I want to do that?
Uh-huh. Right.
But I think you really brought great context to this by exploring the ethics of this. Other comments or questions?
I wanted to make a comment that, first of all, Rabbi Weiner, I think the fact that you're bringing this topic up is very helpful to people in the medical profession, because sometimes I think that we forget about these issues and we forget about thinking about them. Like you mentioned, that we need balance and that there's limits to what we can do. But I think that sometimes expectations often overrule our thoughts and our ability to think about that balance. And I think that even in medical school, I think sometimes these issues are not thought about on a regular basis other than treating patients. You know, we forget about treating the medical professional and thinking about what their needs are. So I think that's why this is a great presentation that you're doing, because it makes us all think about that balance and that we should step back and think about not just the patients, but ourselves when giving medical attention.
I appreciate your comments.
Thanks.
All right, Seth Phillips.
Hi.
Hi. One thing that came to mind is, you know, the 10% tzedakah, or giving of 10% of yourself. And recently I've been reading about the origins of Cedars of Lebanon Hospital, and it's dawned on me that in the last 40 years, charity work by physicians has come to a screeching halt because of the legal obligations involved, at least in Los Angeles. And I've always found that charity work and treating patients in a different setting is very renewing,
mm-hmm.
and gives you back more energy than you put into it. And I just thought that was another side of the coin of what we're talking about and what has changed really in our society, our medical society, in the last decades.
That's an excellent point. I appreciate that. Yeah. So I really should frame it that not only is that expectation of to give something, you know, before we get to those limits, not only is it an expectation of giving of and accepting upon oneself risks, but it actually can be very inspiring and motivating, and really help oneself as they're helping others.
It's a very important subject and a discussion that I think should continue. You know, I would really encourage. You're putting this together in a paper, because I think that the surgical literature and the general medical literature would be advanced by this kind of discussion. And I also feel like having some sort of small group format to talk about this, where we could share some of the individual thoughts of our house staff. Physicians and nurses would also be very helpful.
That's a really great idea. I appreciate that. And I did write this up, and it's a chapter. I have a book coming out in a couple months, and it's a chapter in the book.
All right. Well, that's great. Well, we really appreciate your academic activity and your always willing and thoughtful engagement. And it's great to have you here. And thanks for a terrific Grand Rounds.
Yeah, it's truly my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.